O fool, to think that I could hide from all his piercing eyes the gold and silver and costly stones of his holy workmanship. O fool, could I forget the light that filled my bright spheres, was a reflection of his face who called me from the deep. I well remember, for I heard the mild and holy voice saying, O light, spring up and shine, and I sprang up from the deep. He gave to me a silver scepter and crowned me with a golden crown.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to episode number 389 of the podcast, which is, of course, called Filmwax Radio. And, of course, I'm your host, Adam Shartoff. Today's show, one guest only, poet, the writer. Let's just say the writer, Nick Flynn. But let's see, where do you begin? He has many books of poetry, but his most recent collection is called My Feelings. Many people may know Nick from his memoir called Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, which was eventually adapted into a movie, a screenplay and a movie. And so the book is also out there in printing called Being Flynn, which is the name of course, the film, which starred Paul Dano and Robert De Niro as Nick Flynn and his father, Jonathan Flynn, respectively, and was about Nick's estrangement with his wayward father and their eventual coming together during the period when Nick was working in a homeless shelter, I believe in Boston area, and then his dad showed up looking for a bed one night, and it goes on from there, and his mother's troubled life, and it's a very, very, well, it's a harrowing story, but it's also, I don't know, I have not seen the movie, but I have read the book, Another Bullshit Night, and there is even a subsequent book called The Reenactments, which is about Nick being an executive producer on Being Flynn, and seeing his memoir made into a movie and what that experience was like being on the set. So I was at a poetry reading a number of months ago, and Nick Flynn read a piece of poetry by William Blake, and it turns out it's for an upcoming project and that he's collaborating with. I know one of the people he's collaborating with on this project is the musician Noveller, whose music will provide the backdrop to today's podcast. Anyhow, that is the story. And I met him and I asked him because he had already done another friend's podcast. Paul Lazar, the actor and the director, has been on the show a couple of times. And even for a while, Paul had his own podcast called Talking with Paulie, I believe it was the name of it. And one of the episodes, and I'm sure you can find this online, was with Nick. And I just thought, oh, what a great conversation. And I'd love to have Nick on the show as well. And so when I was at this poetry reading earlier in the late fall, I think it was, I approached him and he said yes immediately. So the other piece of this, this interesting story, I guess, is that Nick is married to the actress Lily Taylor, who is one of the great actresses in our country. And of course, Lily did the podcast some time ago when she was in a movie called Coldlands, which shot upstate New York. And I had on Tom Gilroy, who shot the movie, and also, of course, Lily. So it is nice to sort of bring on her husband, Nick, onto the podcast. And so, as you heard in that little opening sequence there, that little clip, Nick will be reading poetry by William Blake. I just have to say that in this time of, political muscle flexing, we're in a kind of a, I think, in this negative period of time, well, it's no secret, many people may think that, hopefully many of you who listen, where we're now making it much more difficult for anyone to enter this country, and for helping refugees, for building walls between nations. This is a time to share poetry. That's what I'm trying to say. It feels right to have episodes like the one you're about to hear, which are about creativity and leading emotional lives. I think it's important. And so it's certainly what I try to do. So we're going to play this conversation. It's a nice, you know, lengthy conversation. And I certainly hope you do enjoy it. And if you do, pick up some of Nick's work, his memoirs or his books of poetry. You won't be sorry. I think a lot of his poetry is published by Grey Wolf Press, just an FYI, but it's largely available where books are sold, online certainly. So this is it. Nick Flynn is on Film Wax Radio, episode number 389. I don't think I'm going to be back after. I don't think there's much reason. Usually at that point, I'm always asking you to, you know, subscribe on iTunes if you haven't done so, or Stitcher. And we're also now on YouTube, I should mention. I do strip the show of music and other clips and stuff because I run into problems on YouTube. But the show is up there as well, so you can always access it through YouTube or, you know, slowly adding episodes. So that's all I'm going to say. If you do go on iTunes, please do leave a star rating and a comment there. That would be very thoughtful of you. So without any further hesitation, let's get into my conversation with the writer, Nick Flynn. As I mentioned, Paul Lazar was on twice. He was one of my first guests,
yeah,
actually.
Yeah.
Because he was in a friend's movie, a little independent film that nobody ever saw, called Bass Ackwards.
Oh, yeah?
And
I didn't see it, but I love it when he appears in any
oh,
movie.
Oh, you should see it. He has a really funny, small but funny, memorable
really?
Role. Yeah. Yeah, Bass Ackwards. If you can't find it, let me know. I can get a link because the filmmaker is a friend.
Yeah.
And but I had seen him, of course, in a number of things. You don't forget Paul. He's such a striking look, obviously, and he's such a fine actor.
Yeah.
But when I saw it, I spontaneously just decided to hunt him down and invite him on to my and you know, it was really when I right as I started it. So
yeah,
but it was kind of interesting, significant because I thought first of all our rapport. He was so sweet and so giving as a guest.
Mm-hmm.
And unguarded, and just sort of, it was enjoying himself. He was in a little studio in Brooklyn, and it was just really. I just realized, oh, this I can do this, and I can invite people on that I want us to have on, based on instinct of this is somebody I want to talk to. You're kind of the same. I had the same feeling about you. So thanks again for. Do you want to hear yourself? By the way, I can make that happen too.
No.
Okay. Just sit a little closer to.
Yeah.
Just a little bit because sounds a little warmer. But that's it.
Good to sit wherever, yeah.
Yeah. I actually have a nice hardbound copy of your...
Let me get my glasses.
Oh, sure, because you're going to want to read or something.
Yeah, I don't need to hear it, right?
No, not at all. It's just I give people the option.
Too creepy.
Yeah, I'm creeped out enough as it is. But
I've been reading... recording myself lately, even this morning I'm recording myself reading because I'm doing this whole Blake thing, this Blake performance. So,
tell me about that since you brought it up. Why don't you just what's going on with that?
I've been working on this. I gave a talk about Blake at the.
I forgot to take which one. I don't even know which one is mine now. Did you take a couple of big gulps or?
No, I think this is you.
Okay, thanks. Soon it wouldn't matter. By the end of this, we'll be drinking out of the same cup. Don't worry about it.
in 2014, I see here at the Bowery Poetry Club, I sort of was part of this Blake presentation or just talk. Like there was this Blake energy around because some sort of anniversary of his birth or death or something.
William Blake.
And
William T. Blake.
In preparing for that, I found these like thing that you know probably other Blake people know about, but not many people. And I've been a poet for a while, and you know they say he's one of the least poets, the least served by anthologies. Like there's just sort of you know there's like a few poems that people read in anthologies. It is not his like brilliance, and you can't really tell from reading those why he's such a big deal. And
Is that okay? You can have we can have the dog snoring. In the middle.
It's a mainstay now. Whenever I do it, the dog likes to be around you know, people.
And so she makes some noises.
She just snores. If it gets really loud, I might move her.
And so I found this thing that he did called Vala. So he created this sort of this universe, and you know, had these characters in it, Vala and Urizan and Luva, and these different people. That is sort of like a mystical universe, but it's apocalyptic. It's like an apocalyptic prophecy, mm-hmm. and it's in 9 books. He worked on it for 10 years. He never finished it. He abandoned it. And it's just sort of this thing that's like
9 years, and he abandoned it.
Yeah, 10-year project, 9 books, like 1,000, like 4,000 lines, and so I sort of like I read. So I've sort of been wrestling with that for like the last like 3 years, uh-huh. and I've distilled it down. It's sort of this. I've distilled it down to now to 30 pages, all 9 books, and I've done a presentation of it. I did this sort of performance of it last year in Boston at the Museum of Fine Arts with this friend of mine who performs under the name Noveller. She's a guitarist, does these sort of very ambient, weird, loopy guitar stuff, mm-hmm. Pedals and feedback
loops
and things.
And whatnot.
And she's really fantastic. You'd find her, you should look her up. Sarah Lipstadt is her name, but the band's name is Noveller.
Noveller?
Yeah.
I will.
Yeah, and... So we did this. We did one. We did the first book. We did like a performance of the first book, and it was it went well. And then I've managed to get this organization in London to fund us. Is bringing us over to present all 9 books, mm-hmm. in February. So we're presenting the whole thing with her, me, and her, and then this filmmaker from Houston, Gabe Martinez. The 3 of us are going over to present in a few different venues in London for like 10 days. So.
So there'll be a visual component, is what you're saying.
We'll have projections and mm-hmm. sound and text and
It helps. Thing. Does it help the bells and it's not bells and whistles? I don't mean to demean it in any way. But is getting harder?
Well, the Vala is it's unfinished. It's really like it might be sacrilege to some to say like that I'm editing Blake, but I'm deeply distilling Blake. Like deeply, it's a thing he abandoned. So it's like it really needed it. Like in order for me to access it, I've really had to go down and distill it down. It's unbelievably beautiful language. Some people say that some scholar, maybe Northrop Frye or somebody, I forget who it was, or said that the 9th book is like the greatest explosion of creative poetic energy in the English language. It's just like this amazing. It is really amazing. It's an amazing thing, but it's dense. It's like you're just hacking away at this like this. Landscape and world he's created, and you find these like really beautiful passages. Mm. So I have it down to passages.
I see.
She plays. I read some. She plays.
Oh, I get it.
Yeah.
So it's not like you had a sort of an emotional response to.
Yeah. Yeah.
After really distilling it.
Yeah.
So it's not. And as far as I don't think you're claiming you're improving on anything.
I'm distilling it. Yeah.
Yes, I understand. Yeah. And also, I mean, people have been. I think doing far more to like Shakespeare, who is probably the most famous writer of all time, right? And, and his works have been
morphed in many ways,
morphed in every which way possible.
And he, Shakespeare also sampled from a lot of people.
They say, right? Yeah.
There's clear precedence to his plays, but doesn't diminish the plays. And Blake also, I mean, these apocalyptic prophecies, come directly from the Book of Revelations, mm-hmm. There's that energy is in them. So, mm-hmm.
How instrumental is engaging with other existing poetry for you as a poet? Does it inspire your own writing as well?
Well, so my first. Way I was exposed to poetry was by reading other people's poetry, and then usually it was dead poets, and then sort of at some point I realized that some of them were actually alive still, and
that was an accident.
And then I got to meet some of them and become friends with some of them, and it's just sort of a gradual progression. But it's always, that's for me one of the beauties of poetry is you can read a book of poetry in an hour, and you know, you can read a book of poetry like multiple times. Like, not, you know, there's a few novels I've read multiple times, but not many.
Yeah. What is it about it? I mean, they're different, almost disciplines in a sense. So they're unfair, maybe even kind of put them in the same category.
Well, it's also the commitment too. Just, you can read the entire book in an hour.
Right. Sure.
Yeah, you can't read a novel in an hour generally.
Hopefully not.
You need a short story in an hour, so there's that, just that, and then each time you go in, which is probably the same for a great novel too, you enter it in a different way. You're in a different space, psychically, and so it's going to resonate differently. But with poetry, there's just certain poems the ones I return to too are ones that seem really mysterious. I don't really know how they do it, but I'm having some sort of a emotional or energetic or mystical response to them that isn't really, on an intellectual level, not clear why that's happening. You know, it's not like there's a certain pleasure in going back into it because it's entering into like mystery, a mysterious experience, a mystical experience even sometimes.
Do you remember one of your earliest heroes or earliest?
Of poetry?
One of the early poets that really...
Well, I was very lucky. I mean,
at some point you said, I want to do this.
Well, you know, there's always been, like, it, you know, if you go back, you go back and you know, we all have poems, like I think. I mean, it's terrible to make gross generalizations because probably some people don't have poems, but, you know, fairy tales and nursery rhymes and things like that were always sort of, you know, were part of growing up. And at a certain point, in sixth grade, I was required to memorize a poem, which I think was a cool thing. Like it seemed like, and I don't remember it being onerous. I remember it being kind of like, okay, I'll do this. And because I was really very morbid as a sixth grader, and I was reading Edgar Allan Poe. I'm like, well, I'm gonna memorize The Raven, which is like a 4-page poem, and I did.
Okay,
I memorized this long poem, and I still have like maybe a page of it. You know, I can still like. It's just sort of in the way it gets in there to memorize something that early, it gets in very deeply. And then,
right, you know, it sticks. Yeah.
Yes. And it gets in like cellular level or something. And then, you know, the one book of poetry, you know, sort of, you know, wonderfully or tragically around my house that I can remember was Ariel. That was like sort of the book of poetry that was around our house. I didn't really read it, but it was, I knew it was there. I got into like every teenager, I think, still to this day, got into Bukowski at a certain point, you know, and then rejected Bukowski.
Okay.
You know, like, so, you sort of embrace and reject.
Oh, as opposed to the other way around. Yeah.
It could, yeah. It depends, I guess, who you are. But and then it got into then I got into poetry. Like, as an undergraduate at UMass Amherst, I took a workshop. I heard there was a famous poet there, I was a creator. I was an English major and was studying writing, and I was just like, I don't know anything about poetry. Like, I'll take a class with this guy. I hadn't heard of James Tate, who's, you know, great American poet. And so I took a workshop with him, and he just had us read a contemporary book of poetry, maybe a book that came out that year. One book a week, so 14 books. We read a book a week, and that's when I realized you could read a book pretty quickly.
Yeah,
and you could actually have an experience with the book pretty quickly, and you write something, you know, how to write a page or two pages or something.
So it required your full engagement.
And it was such a crazy range of like voices and dictions and styles.
And these were, again, new, these were
contemporary living poets. Okay. Yeah, I don't think any of them were dead. Yeah. No, they're all alive. Yeah. They're all alive. They're all, I think the books might've just come out that year. Like, he just sort of, and he had fantastic taste, like really good taste, unless that was a particularly good year for poetry, I don't know, but they all seem like very sort of major books I can still remember. I can remember all of them, you know. Dennis Johnson was one of them. Like, before he wrote Jesus' Son, he, you know, was a poet. And Carolyn Forché, Etheridge Knight, Charles Wright, they were just like this, you know, Michael Burkhardt, Lizelle Mueller.
And this was I guess we're around 1980?
82. Yeah, it was the fall of 82. Mm-hmm. I was taking that poetry class, yeah. Yeah.
And I guess your life at home was pretty chaotic, so...
Yeah, I guess, it, you know, one
when one's in the midst of it, it doesn't sort of, it just seems like that's what life is. So
Well, let's see, you would have been still pretty young. You were living in Massachusetts. Amherst, I guess, reasonably close to where your mom was.
Yeah,
it was
like a 2-hour motorcycle ride, yeah. Yeah, I had a motorcycle. I'd go back and forth on a motorcycle.
Not on the turn.
Mass Pike, yeah.
On the Mass Pike, on 90.
Yeah, I'd shoot on the motorcycle, yeah, back and forth.
Did you pay tolls? Yeah, of course you did.
No.
No?
No, we had a friend who worked, who got some summer job for the Mass Pike, and he pointed out that there was a... That he just was like, well, how do you get on the pike and off? Do you pay? And he's like, no, there's just you just get off at the police station and just go through the gates. So we just always never, ever paid. We always went just through where the workers went and just waved to the cops and just went through. As if we were working, what do you do with the cops? You go, you just wave to them. And that's what we did. We went right by the state police station, and there's a gate there that says, do not go out this gate. You go through the gate, and then you're out in without pay. We did it every time.
This is a different time, too. I don't know if you can quite get away. Also, I just drove on the Pike about Thanksgiving weekend, and they don't even have toll booths anymore. So now, I mean, it's all operated, you know, with these scanners now. So
on the other end, before
a different world.
Without being able to do that, the other end, there was a way where I literally drove
the Berkshires
across a field to not pay in the other end, on the UMass end. I would drive across a field, and then through like a break in a fence down a hill on my motorcycle, down a hill out to a road, sort of skid like dirt bike. Like a dirt bike.
Evel Knievel was still around then.
Yeah,
right?
So,
in 82, 83, or in the early 80s in general, which is around the time I moved to Boston myself, I was there living in the Jamaica Plain area from 83 to 85.
That was a good time to be there.
It was a different time, and I don't think, and I had this, my granddad's Chevy Impala, which was like a real road hog. It was a boat.
Yeah, a boat, yeah.
Yeah, and driving all the way across, how much, that might have been $250. I mean, I don't know.
I know, but that was like a six-pack.
That's true.
I wasn't going to spend that on tolls. I mean,
well, that's another question about your drives across.
We'd already spent it on beer for the drive.
I see.
Yeah,
okay.
So we didn't have the money.
It was much less boring a drive.
Yeah.
Understood. Well, there must have been a couple of close calls. I'm just, even in sober drives across the turnpike, But I'm just wondering if by then you were already so engaged in poetry and in love with poetry. It sounds like even just how you're reminiscing about that professor and those particular that exposure and the discovery of living poets and thought, well, of course, I'm living and I like poetry. I could be a living poet. That kind of gave a sense of order or contrast to the time at home because your mom was really struggling.
Yeah. That was actually semester that I was taking the poetry workshop is the semester she committed suicide.
Oh.
And it was right in December. And so the semester was just ending. But I left school before it ended. We struggle in it's not a very sort of cinematic way. It's a very quiet way. So,
and you don't think about
my people.
The poets?
My people. I don't know, my family.
Oh, you're okay.
Yeah, we're not like Italian or Catholic or something. You know?
I see.
So Jewish. I mean, we're waspy. Waspy struggles, you know, almost invisible.
There's not something where there was a lot of manifestation.
Well, I say that if I say that, yeah, if I say that, but then if I actually talk about things, there was huge manifestations. Yeah, if I list them, but then to me they were diminished. Like I didn't pay attention to them. So
as I was kind of just doing my due diligence, though, but I was, you know, thinking like obviously going from single mother struggling with alcohol, maybe meant I don't know mental illness. Is it safe to say?
No, I don't think she was mentally ill at all. No,
okay, okay.
No, she wasn't. No, she wasn't mentally ill at all.
Okay,
no, unless I'm mentally ill.
And that's the filter that you're looking through. No, I don't know enough about that. So, but just the idea of losing her, and then poetry, and then working in the Pine Street Inn.
Yeah,
it just seems like choosing. Maybe it wasn't feeling like a choice. I don't know. It seems like
to end up in the shelter.
Yeah, and to kind of pursue poetry and writing. Well, poetry seems to be more of where you were heading to be a poet. It just seems like beyond romantic at this stage, you know, these choices. Especially someone young in their 20s.
Yeah, I mean, I had other things I was doing, too. I mean, I was, you know, when she died, I was an electrician's apprentice. I had a trade, which I continued doing for about a year. And then I just sort of, it sort of lost meaning, or maybe I didn't continue it that long.
Was your mentor, what do they call it? No, what do they call the your apprenticing to, for
a master electrician? Or
yeah, I mean, maybe he was just, I'm saying he, I assume it was a he.
It was a he, yeah.
It was a rock, maybe some, a rock or somebody just, was he a friend, like could be a friend to you as well?
Oh, no. Okay. I mean, they were fine, the people I worked for. There was, you know, that was a whole another complicated story, which, you know, it was my mother's boyfriend was this drug dealer, gangster type guy. And these were the people that worked with him. The electrician was, they just needed someone that did electrical work.
Well, I get it. I'm just searching for that male figure because I want that
mentor
for you
or something,
in
or
your story. I want that in your narrative.
Well,
I want
one,
there to be
well, there was
that
one,
guy.
Like when I was working with those guys, there was one drunken carpenter, Peter, who was, you know, kind of a jerk, but you know, we worked together. He was, you know, pretty hardcore alcoholic. You know, he was living literally like a, what is that, Chris Farley thing. He was living in a trailer. He was living in
down
his truck
by the river
in the state park, you know, with a cooler.
Yeah.
You know, and left his wife for his paradise. And and he was just sort of like, this doesn't look good, you know, like I was just like that. But he was like, you know, he'd come into work every day hungover, and he was a good carpenter. And but then I was like, okay, I'll just keep doing this work. And then at a certain point, I got into UMass. I got into
your writing samples?
No, I don't know how. It was just like a Mooney wedding or something. Like I went to a public school. Everyone who goes to the public school, the counselor or something, just put your name into the state school.
Oh, they do that almost?
I don't know. I don't remember applying, but I got an acceptance letter. It wasn't something.
I wish I had had that experience.
Yeah, and suddenly I was accepted to UMass. I was like, did I apply to UMass? Like, I didn't remember doing that. But
could your mother have done it?
No, definitely not. No, definitely
I don't know.
Not.
You know, just
so I got into UMass, but I wasn't going to go. I was like, I got this job. I'm making good money. Like, why would I go? And the carpenter just said to me, which was like sort of a mentor experience. He said, don't be an asshole. You got your whole life to work. Like, go to school. Like, don't be an idiot.
That's good advice.
Yeah, yeah. And I was like, oh, okay. He's like, these jobs, you're always going to have this stupid job, you know? This is not a problem. So I was an electrician. Then when I got out, when my mother died, like, it made less sense to do that. And working with the homeless made more sense for some reason. I don't know why, but it made more sense. So, and I worked there for almost 10 years. I mean, throughout my 20s,
oh,
I worked there.
At the
shelter.
At the shelter, right.
Maybe 7 years or something, but it was a long time. Like, that's like...
That is a long time.
7 years is like 10 years.
That age, especially.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I didn't leave till I was like 30, so...
Right. It was a dick... It was a... That's what you did in your 20s. I get it. That area of Massachusetts, Amherst also, you were there for... You said you didn't finish?
I dropped out, so I was there for like 3.5 years.
It's amazing, right? Yeah.
And I
have a
out.
Similar...
Yeah.
Story about my 3 years, but that especially that is like kind of a bastion, that Amherst with a number of colleges,
yeah,
Bert,
the Five Sisters,
yeah, and there it's very liberal, very
yes.
progressive. It was during a very early days of PC, where I wonder how striking that was for you and how much maybe it influenced you. There had to be kind of like a contrast.
To be political or like to work with the homeless? Or?
No. Well, I'm not so much political as just as social, I guess, socially progressive more than – I mean, it definitely was politically progressive. A lot of students chose those schools because they came from that kind of upbringing or background. But I imagine there was quite a contrast from the rougher – you know, sides of like Boston growing up.
Yeah,
there.
Well, it was interesting.
Or the neighborhood you grew up in, which was very...
Well, it wasn't a rough neighborhood I grew up in, but my mother dated rough guys.
Rough guys.
And like, so that, you know, I came from, when I was going to school, I was still working with the gangsters. And so my job on the weekends, I'd ride home on my motorcycle, work with the gangsters, make money, go back to school. And yeah, it was strange, but I was also then, you know, my girlfriend at the time up there at school, you know, was very progressive. She was in the, I don't know if she was in the Radical Student Union, but she was, you know, she was working at like Earth Foods, at the sort of, yeah, you know, alternative places. And yeah, she was more connected to that sort of alternative
political thing. But I already had a political consciousness going in there, like working. I had a political consciousness from just growing up. Like I just had this sort of class consciousness.
It was just like in your system already. It was because that didn't seem to come from. Although I don't know, maybe it did come from your parents or your grandparents or
no. It came from. It probably came from my first girlfriend when I was in high school, or just out of high school. I guess still in high school. Her father was really left. He was a history professor at a high school, and they were just really like, and you know, I think Reagan was just getting into power or something, and like they were just really like politically engaged. Like, and I just really was interested in it. I could sort of see like and it sort of made sense. Like that leftist view made sense to me. And UMass was very leftist, so I took some that classes like that up there, but I wasn't. I kind of didn't really feel like I fit into like the radical student union and stuff. They felt it felt a little elitist or something to me.
Oh yeah, I could see that.
So a little bit like so I didn't really fit in there. But I ended up getting a house with these
very righteous
radical lesbian feminists that they weren't all lesbians, but they were radical. And
branding the group.
They were like connected to the radical student union and stuff. Yeah, and they were like sort of, so I was in that group.
Yeah.
Like, I was always in the periphery of things in some way. But I definitely wasn't in like with the MBA crowd or the fraternity crowd, or I was more in the leftist crowd.
Gotcha. Huh.
So going into work with the homeless was another political, it felt like a political act.
I remember also a little later in the 80s, maybe 86, I had been going to this lefty summer camp. I grew up kind of in a very lefty.
Where was that?
It was initially upstate here, up in the Hudson Valley.
What's it called?
Camp Thoreau, as in our poet. Mm-hmm. It was outside of New Paltz, in a town called Wallkill.
Mm-hmm.
And then at some point there was like a divide and the guy that was running our summer camp day to day, he took the group up to Vermont. And by then I was old enough to be a counselor, camp counselor. So, and I was going to school. And so I decided to go up to Vermont. So it was near the New Hampshire border, but it was up in Vermont. And in one of my first summers as a staffer, I met a girl named Sarah her name is Sarah, who was actually going to Dartmouth. Which is not a lefty.
Why, of course, is her name Sarah?
Because it's always I don't know. Sarah is like the name of the archetype of who I'm describing. I think Sarah. I don't know what she saw in me because I was not, even though I was going to this lefty camp and played guitar and I wasn't like she was part of the student SDS right mm-hmm. Student for Democratic Society mm-hmm. I think it was called
yeah.
So she was, she was really committed to it. Wasn't just like a, you know, sort of a phase for her. And so I was just really impressed with her. And she was very attractive. I was very attracted to her. But I just, and I remember her telling me that I reminded of her friends back home. And I know she had a difficult relationship with her family on some level. And they were from Arlington, you know. I don't know what it was. There was some sort of problems, I know. I just never got her to really open up about it, you know, and we weren't together that long. But she had a real influence on me in that way, too. Like, I no longer felt like I should just be, I don't know, casual about it. There was so much going on in the world at the time. Not that there isn't now.
But I think that's the thing. I think you know, whoever you get attracted to or gets attracted to you or who you end up hanging out with, it's not like, I don't think it's completely accidental, you know, like if you went and talked to someone from, you know, a young Trump type person or something, you know, maybe that would just, you wouldn't click with that person, mm-hmm. you know, like that would just be a thing. You just wouldn't really, you wouldn't have a kinship maybe if, you know, so you find your tribe and your, you know, whatever it is, whatever led you to that point. So yeah, growing up with like a single mother who was working class and, you know, we had to think about money and things like that. One of my first like class things though happened when I was 8. I'm writing about it now, because I have this 8-year-old daughter. So it was when I was 7. There was a guy in my hometown named Mr. Mann. I think I talked about this in another interview too, because I've been working on this book for a while now. And
is this more of a memoir or?
Yeah, well, I don't know what it is. It's like something. Yeah, fairy tale maybe, but it's
verse.
Yeah,
prose.
And he you know, he's like sort of a hermit type, lived in his house in town. If you went near the house, my grandmother said he would shoot you with a shotgun. You shouldn't, couldn't go near it. And so I spent the whole summer trying to get as close as I could to it.
The Boo Radley.
Yeah, to try to like, to try to get him to shoot me. It was with rock salt. Like, it wouldn't kill you, but it would like sting you.
Oh, he actually did shoot with something.
That's what he would shoot. He'd shoot you with this rock salt.
Wasn't just
Well, I don't know if he did. He never shot me, but that was the story.
Okay.
But I was hoping he would, because for some reason, which is a whole nother story, why I would hope him to do that. But then that winter he died. And I found out when I was eight, he died. Like, I spent the summer, you know, tracking him and trying to get close to his house. And then that winter he died, and I found out he died because the city, the town, or the gas company, the electric company, shut his heat off, and he froze to death. And I was just like, it was sort of really the beginning of class consciousness. I'm like, they killed him because he's poor? Like, I was just sort of shocked. I was just like, that's wrong. Like, and because he was really like a mythic figure to me, too. He was this mythic figure in my town. And I really like paid a lot of attention to him, an inordinate amount of attention. I'd see him everywhere. Like, I would just track him and just see him. Like, he was like, you know, if you're in a crowd, like, there he is. The others.
Sure.
Yeah.
He was glowing.
And then he died. They killed him.
Yeah.
The town killed
but
him.
But does it take time for you to freeze to death?
No.
You could just
work with the homeless. Yeah. The people, you die quick. Yeah. You die quick. Hypothermia sets in. You die peacefully. You don't feel it. You're sort of numb and drunk. It's like you're drunk. It mimics drunkenness. So you're sort of, you're delirious. Yeah.
A level of shock on
something,
right?
Yeah.
Wow.
No, you can go pretty fast. You can freeze it up pretty quick.
I just thought maybe the time leading up to that phase where you're really cold must just take a while, and then you just sort of say, let me go someplace.
You know, suppose you're sleeping in the night and they shut the heat off in the middle of the night. They shut your power off.
And you're maybe older? Is he?
Yeah,
he was old.
He was old,
so
yeah.
He was an
old guy,
probably especially fast.
He was like in his 90s.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
he was like 92. So,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But he was getting around, though. He'd walk around all town. He was like a guy, yeah. So.
Yeah. He could have been lived to 93 or 4. You know, you never know.
Even longer.
That's true.
Who knows, yeah.
So this is another work based in nostalgia, anyway, if not...
I hate to use the word nostalgia, I know.
Memory.
Yeah,
sense
thank
memory.
You, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
That's a better word. I agree with you. I'm so naive, I apologize.
This is another one of your nostalgic works.
Sorry. Well, you wrote a trilogy. That's how it was
nostalgia trilogy,
marketed.
I think it's called. It's a nostalgia trilogy.
memoirs. Well, you're still a young guy. I mean, well, I'm roughly your age, I suppose.
Roughly young.
So I like to think of you as a young guy in the scheme of things.
Not as old as Mr. Man.
No. That's why I love that Mr. Man living. I like the idea of him living to 96 or 7, because then I still would be firmly middle-aged.
You're only halfway there.
Exactly. I really like that thought. Sadly, I'm already like yourself. I think I'm past the halfway mark already. That was a tough one for
me. Halfway mark.
Yeah. I mean, you know, knowing, that was like that I could no
longer.
You're
talking about 50 or
crunching
something?
Numbers past 50. But yeah, for sure 50.
Yeah.
Because no matter how you crunch the numbers.
You're going downhill?
Yeah. I mean, you're just.
You're on the other side of the mountain.
Yeah. You've lived longer than you've lived longer than you are going to.
Maybe I should read some Blake. Maybe that would help you.
That's always a
pick. Yeah, maybe that would like.
Now, is this again this is the
from
work that
Valen
you were.
Valenite the Second, yeah, because that would, you know, if you're.
Because before, by the way, I was going to ask you if you could still remember some of the Raven, just as a kind of like a test, and I'll just take your word for it. But read this.
Okay, this is the end of the fifth night. Oh, did I keep the horses of the day in silver pastures? Oh, I refused the Lord of Day, the horses of his prince. Oh, did I close my treasuries with roofs of solid stone, and darkening all my palace walls with envyings and hate. Oh, fool, to think that I could hide from all his piercing eyes the gold and silver and costly stones of his holy workmanship. Oh, fool, could I forget the light that filled my bright spheres, was a reflection of his face who called me from the deep. I well remember, for I heard the mild and holy voice saying, O light, spring up and shine, and I sprang up from the deep. He gave to me a silver scepter and crowned me with a golden crown and said, Go forth and guide my son who wanders in the ocean. I went not forth. I hid myself in black clouds of my wrath. I called the stars around my feet in the night of councils dark. The stars threw down their spears and fled naked away. We fell.
Does that help you? Any? With worrying about entering the abyss?
Well, it just it sounds like almost like the night. Mm-hmm. The night part, yeah. The stars throwing their spears. I know the feeling. I know that feeling. That's a familiar sense.
That's also a line of his that he stole. He stole that from himself, or else he repurposed that line, because that's also in The Tiger.
Oh.
The stars threw down their spears, yeah. That's like I believe that's a line in The Tiger.
Huh.
Yeah. Heaven threw down her spears.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it's a beautiful... It's a beautiful image.
Yeah.
I'm sure he may not have even been aware of that he borrowed from himself.
He may not have been aware,
of it that he did that.
Oh yeah, I steal from myself all the time.
Aware, or after the fact.
No,
sometimes?
No, not always. No, not at all.
Yeah.
No, not always. Yeah.
Did you want to read another passage?
I was trying to think, because that one seemed almost too pretty, like compared to like some that are like quite that are quite like. I was hoping to frighten you a little bit more.
There was that element. It seemed like gods and wrathful gods and.
I think right at the beginning, there's some. Yeah, I'll do this one. This is nice. This could be good. Okay. This is from Night the First. I see the invisible knife. I see the shower of blood. I see the swords and spears of futurity. Though in the brain of man we live, and in his circling nerves, though this bright world of all our joy is in the human brain, let us refuse the plow and spade, the heavy roller and spiked harrow. Burn all these cornfields, throw down all these fences. Fattened on human blood and drunk with wine of life is better far than all these labors of the harvest and the vintage. See the river run red with the blood of men, swell lustful round my rocky knees. Stuff like that.
Wow.
Yeah.
What has he got against agriculture?
The whole world. It's like it's an apocalyptic vision. It's end of the world. It's like he's it's over. It's about creative destruction. You know, you gotta wipe the slate clean and start again. So,
and if it's even before global. With climate change and all that, because there's definitely that anxiety now about the end of the world.
Yeah, there's a lot that feels very contemporary in it.
I do feel a little anxiety when you were reading the first passage too, because I feel really small, it makes me I think this is common. This is not uncommon anyway. Like when you're looking up at the stars, which is not. Mm-hmm. Because of the infrequency of it, living in a city like New York, you don't see the open universe. Yeah. We just see occasional stars. Oh, it's pretty. But when you get out of the city and then you're exposed to it, it feels sometimes so overwhelming and beautiful, of course, but also that feeling of feeling so small and lost and insignificant. It's scary. And I had that same sort of anxiety when I'm in the open sea, that I feel just so small, and the sea feels dangerous, very dangerous. Yeah. Like it's something I can't control, of course. And I'm just
I think it's good to be afraid of certain things.
Yeah,
yeah. or just to see one's place in the, it's almost you can dissolve into it, into something bigger, or feel overcome by it. It is like sort of a, so you sort of flutter between the two, feeling insignificant and then just feeling part of it at the same time, you know?
Yeah.
Ideal, I guess, I don't know. I guess the ideal is to feel part of it, and not like crushed by it.
That's a good point. When you were, you have a 7-year-old daughter, you said?
She's 8 now.
8?
Yeah.
I think I met her. Only because I think when I could be wrong. I was up in upstate last summer, the summer before. I think my ex-wife, who's an actress, had...
What's her name?
Karen Pittman.
Mm-hmm.
She was working on a play, and they were doing it at Bard.
Uh-huh.
Which I know is near
where
you guys
close,
have a home, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I saw... I had done... your Lily had been on the podcast with Cold Lands, which was shot up in that area, too.
Yeah,
and Tom... Also, I think those were, he did it separately, but nevertheless, so I was up there, ran into her at a cafe. Uh-huh. This was after I had already met her. I may have looked a little familiar to her.
Yeah, yeah.
But I just ran into her there. I brought this up for, oh, so yeah, so I think maybe it's possible your daughter was with her. I'm trying to remember.
Well, if there was, yeah, I mean, if you can't remember, I don't know, but if there was a child with her, it's very likely would have been our daughter, yeah.
Yeah. I'm thinking there was. You know. I think there was. My kid was with there, and so I was very focused on that, I guess.
Yeah.
But it was a surprise.
Yeah.
To see anybody been on my podcast at the cafe. Yeah. I didn't know. I put it all together, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway. But that's got to – do you – I mean, I guess what I was trying to get at earlier was this whole thing, which the big question – is how you would get from the kind of life that took you through the 20s and working at the at Pine Street Inn,
mm-hmm.
yeah, Pine Street Inn, which was the shelter. You're obviously reconnecting with your father at that point in a very unusual way.
Yeah,
and then and your mother having died only, I'm guessing, a few years before that.
Yes, yeah, she would have died about 4 years before I met my father.
Okay.
4 or 5 years, yeah.
And I don't remember in the timeline when you gave up drinking or self-destructive
behavior. A couple years after I met my father, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's still continuing at that point.
Still in my 20s, yeah.
Okay.
Tail end of my 20s, yeah.
And did you stop that self-destructive behavior, we'll call it the general blanket mm-hmm. term, was that while you were still at the shelter, working
yeah.
at the shelter?
Uh-huh. Yeah, there were a lot of sober people working at the shelter.
Oh, sure.
You know, I mean, part of the irony is part of my job at the shelter for at various points was to drive people to detox, you know, to take, and I was still using at the time. And so it's sort of an irony. I was very aware of alcoholism and of, the consequences of drug use and alcohol and like on very serious levels. Yeah.
Right.
Yet it didn't stop me. Until it did, you know, but I went for quite a while. I mean, I probably was at the shelter for 5 years using.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and
sure.
You would think with it all around you, with the consequences at your, literally, you're picking it up off
funny.
Your feet. The brain is funny. Yeah.
Yeah. How you just sort of justify.
I was studying alcoholism in, you know, getting a degree in like social work and stuff. I was like studying it, the effects and yeah.
This was after.
This was after I dropped out of school. I got my degree eventually, but by taking classes at UMass Boston and other places. And I sort of went into like a social work track when I was working at the shelter.
Mm-hmm.
So that was what that is.
And so at some point, it sounds like, though, I guess I would imagine you're struggling, so especially because if you're doing drugs or drinking to excess, that you're numbing yourself from pain. It's generally why people do it, not always. But I'm just wondering when that change occurred. It doesn't. I know it's not overnight.
When did I stop wanting to numb myself from pain? Or
yeah, and when you decided to kind of go forward in a healthy, because you know the a lot of people don't survive that sort of a recipe. It's a recipe for a real disaster.
Sure.
To extremely self-destructive parents.
Yeah.
Your dad survived miraculously too.
Yeah, I mean, sort of survived. I mean,
he was around still?
No, he died a couple of years ago, but he died of old age.
Right. I mean, no, right.
Basically, yeah.
Sure. Yeah. And your mom's story, you know, and she sounds like I'm not going to put a narrative on that because it's I just don't know enough and I shouldn't anyway. But you should have turned out to be drink yourself to death or something like that. You know what I mean? I mean, it just
there are many ways. I mean, there's a few things in that question. There's a, you know, to get sober, to quit drinking, or to quit doing drugs. I mean, you know what they say is that there's some sort of a, you know, moment of grace or something. If something it's sort of unmeasurable. You don't really know why. There's no real rhyme or reason to it. There's no like, this is the moment or this is the thing that would do it. You know, there's no. you know, so the, and I for me that's the case. There's no real, like, I can't really point to something, but it's also like the use of drugs and alcohol. I mean, you know, they were very good friends for a long time. It wasn't just to numb pain. It was also, you know, there was a, it created community. It created a tribe of people. I mean, you know, I'm sure you were drinking and using drugs in your day, and
you never
drank or used drugs.
Really?
Not to excess, I'm saying, but there's in the culture,
yes,
there's around.
Yes,
and there's a certain, like, you know, there's certain, you know, there's a certain.
Sure.
The, at least the way I did it, there, you know, it
created, I absolutely did, and I just waited longer to do it, than you know,
so
a late starter.
But it created a lot of, there's a lot of good that came out of it, a lot of like necessary things, like it sort of, like, you know, very very likely kept me alive, you know, for a long time, until it didn't, until it sort of became you know, problematic, you know, at a certain point it turns and becomes problematic. So, you know, sometimes it's the solution, you know, it's not always the problem.
True.
And when you're younger, like you know, you don't have many resources, many tools, to deal with emotional things or to deal with, just even how to, like, navigate the world. And drugs and alcohol,
you're doing that on your own.
Drugs and alcohol could be like an easy ticket. Like, this is the answer to a lot of those questions. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's good or bad. I think it can be. At a certain point, if it turns bad, then you should probably do something else about it. You know,
like
if it.
Well, I think for me, I don't think it was such a threat because, although it could have been, but it, I mean, for
you might not
for
be an
story,
addict. You might not be an addict.
I don't think I'm an addict.
Yeah,
luckily,
yeah.
But also. But maybe you know, I don't know. But also, I had parents who were kind of guiding me, you know. And, you know, I mean, they were far from perfect, God knows, but they were there and they were loving. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm saying is that it was set up, you know, you were set up for a very different path. And so it's just always, to me, kind of a big deal when you
but
you chose things like maybe you were helping your mom. I don't know. Maybe you were there and you were helping your mother. That was your role.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a few years since I've read another book.
Helper. So then my role became to help in the shelter.
And then you chose a role where you are helping people, and social work in general is about learning how to do that and to aid people that need help. And so perhaps that was a helping yourself on some level. I don't know.
But I think
armchair psychiatrist.
But I think we all have, like, you know, many, you know, we contain multitudes. It's like that can be one aspect of it, and then there can be other aspects that are, you know, more, you know, less altruistic. There could be some that are more damaging, some that are more purely creative, some that are more spiritual. Like, and they're all like, it's a very strange mix of what creates a person, you know. There's not really one thing, as far as I can tell. So, and working in the shelter wasn't one thing either. It was like many things. It was political. Yeah. It was a weird tribe. It was a place to get drunk and get laid. It was
for
a weird
for the people that
for me
for you too.
Well, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we all slept together. Everyone who worked there slept together. Yeah.
Okay. You mean the staff?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, some of the staff slept with the people that came in.
Okay.
It was like,
man, I've literally, speaking of shelters, I live my own shelter.
I mean, like any job. It was like any job. Like, you know,
okay, true.
Coworkers sleep with each other.
That's true.
You know,
right.
And then sometimes you sleep with the clients. I mean, it's just, that's right. I don't know.
Yeah, no, you're right.
It's like you're in the world. So,
well said.
So it was many things. It wasn't just to say that I was there as like some altruistic saint wouldn't be accurate. And to say, even after I quit drinking, that suddenly my life got better and I got on a good track and stopped being self-destructive. Like, that wouldn't be accurate either. You know, so it's always a daily navigation through these, you know, to figure out who you are and why you do things, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why I write, actually. It's sort of to figure that out, too. I sort of like to, you know, push myself into uncomfortable places in my writing. It's sort of as a way to sort of think like, oh, there's this thing I haven't talked about that I do. Like, let's sort of see what that is. Like, if I look at that a little closer, you know, and try to figure out you know, sources of behavior and things, you know. So
the writing could have been definitely also a nice contribution too. I might have to wake her up. She's so loud.
It's funny. The time with my kid. It's so strange. The the noveller who I'm doing the Blake thing with just texted me that says, "You're on the radio right now reading Embrace Noir." That's so funny.
Like public radio or something.
I don't know. Yeah.
Interesting.
Well,
You know, if I find their, her music, I can add it to the
yeah. Two L's.
Oh, thank you. I was totally, yeah. I figured I was going to have to. I didn't decide it. You know, it's funny because as I mentioned, I have my hardbound edition, and I don't know. I think it's in my storage or something,
which I have to go.
Well, you know, yeah, I figured. Well,
yeah.
It was a.
I would wrap it for Christmas.
I had to run into Manhattan this morning to pick up a Lego gift card for my son. Anyway, so so I stopped by the Strand.
Yeah,
I actually was going to try to get another one of your titles, but apparently they're so popular because the guy said, "Oh, we should have every title," and then he looked and only this.
Huh. Okay.
So yeah. I hope that means good things.
Depends if you're a glass half empty or glass half full kind of guy.
Trying to be I drank half the glass, yeah. And
which is better, half empty or half full? I never really figured that out. Really.
I think the bullies empty. Will say half full is the optimistic view, right? And then
I guess yeah,
but
it never made sense to me.
Either way, I interpret it generally as I'm half as thirsty as you know I need to be or something like that. So. Well, I think I mentioned this to Lily when I talked to her some time ago. And we didn't have a lot of time because it was one of those cases where it was around the Cold Lands and you kind of have a slot.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, publicists are kind of putting together the whole day. And so, but I remembered that as a, I had, when I moved back to, after living in Boston, I moved back to New York in the late 80s and I joined the public theater because I grew up, my parents were members and they would take me to these plays that were scarring for a little kid to see, you know. But by the time I, you know, was of age, young guy, and it was still relatively inexpensive to go see a play at the public theater. So I became a member, and I remember it was 88 or 89.
At the Forman. And
I was introduced to...
Forman? Richard Forman? Or was it... Who was the play, right?
She did this one play that was... I just remember I was sitting in the front with my then-girlfriend and my dad. Because I... You know, just got extra tickets to this play, and this woman walks out. This young woman, she's so young. She looked like a teenager back then, too. Yeah. And she still looks amazing, but she was like, I was like, she's so unique and unusual. Who is this person, this actress? And she was so good.
Yeah.
It just, and I never forgot. And then I started, of course, to see her in films and do stuff. And I was like, not surprised at all.
She came to New York to do a Richard Forman play.
It could have been. She remembered it because she told me the play in that interview. So I would have to bring it up.
Which was such a big deal. The Forman plays. When I first came to New York, I'd go see all his plays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. You have one play at least.
Called
if off the top of my head, Alice invents a little game and always wins.
Alice invents a little game and Alice always wins.
And Alice always wins.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
See, I shouldn't memorize these
things. That's okay. Yeah.
No, I wrote it down.
Yeah.
And Alice always wins. So that's already been a while, but that was I noticed that was not performed in New York.
It's been performed now since then. Yeah, it was performed I think last year in a theater in Chicago, Forget Me Not Theater in Chicago.
Oh yeah, performed. That's what I think I saw that.
Yeah, name. Yeah.
Okay,
they just did it. Yeah.
And
so it gets performed once in a while. Yeah.
What was that about?
What was it about? I mean, it also had some sort of it's sort of this like broad allegory, maybe. Mm-hmm. I never even really tried to describe it, but maybe that's what it is. It was inspired by this, in part by a blackout that the city had one summer, and all these businessmen that were on the front page of the New York Times couldn't get home, and they just slept outside. They just like were sleeping on benches and stuff in these nice suits, like mm-hmm. All around like Penn Station. It was really hot. It was like, you know, 100 degrees, and people were just sleeping like out like. They were just instantly became homeless. They couldn't get home.
Yeah.
They just slept. And it was just this weird, very strange photograph. Like, and so it sort of was that. It was sort of like...
Curled up under newspapers.
Yeah. But not even curled up. They just looked you know, they just took over a bench. It's sort of like their version of homelessness is they just, this is my bench. Like, and they, it sort of has some of that. Like it's in a city. It's all outside a building. And it's someone, the lead character, leaves the building, gets locked out, like forgets his keys, and then he just never gets back in the building the entire time. And there's a businessman who's like, the power's out in the city, and that, so that's maybe why he can't get in. But he's like, I just had to,
you know. It's like almost like in reverse, a no exit.
Yeah.
No
yeah,
entrance. He's out.
Yeah, no entrance. Yeah, you can't get in. The building is a character at some point because he rings a bell and the building talks to him. But they won't. They sort of half buzz him in. And he can't get in time. He can't get the buzzer in time.
So they're fucking with him. Or the
And then eventually, once he sort of half gets in or something. There's like four characters in it. So that never get inside. No one ever gets inside.
Do you ever think of writing another or working on another play eventually?
I know. I mean, I think about it a lot, but I think about a lot of things. I've been working on something for Lily, for a long time, just because I live with this, amazing one of the best actresses there is. And
definitely.
It's possible I don't have, the aptitude. Maybe poetry has destroyed me or something to write, to move people around in the world in a certain way. That play is very odd. It's an odd play. Mm-hmm. I mean, I really enjoyed doing it, and I'm working on this other thing now. I might do it again, but other projects just always come up. There's always other projects that I sort of I am working on some sort of screenplay or play type thing, mm-hmm. and then I put it aside and then do Blake for a while and do poems.
Right, I understand.
Write about Mr. Man.
Yeah,
there's this four or five projects going on at once, but one of them
is the order presents itself with a number of different components to what might be your next thing.
It's whatever sort of demands my attention or whatever,
right?
Or just my attention goes to.
Yeah, because imagine another Hollywood movie could be, if it's a good one, that's always the rub, right? If it's a lucrative one, that's helpful. Like on occasion, that could be.
Money would be helpful.
Yeah, that's what I'm getting at.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Sure. Especially in 10 years from now, especially.
College.
I'm starting to think, I have half that time, so I'm but fortunately, actually, his mother is doing, I think, has a great career, not have time for podcasting. But I didn't want to spend that much time on as we wind down, because I don't want to keep too long, but I know that there's a lot of other interviews and information out there about making Another Night, Another Bullshit Night in Suck City, adapting it into a film, and now they've decided that your book is called Being Flynn.
Well, just that one film tie-in book, it's still called Another Bullshit Night in Suck City,
But you may find it under either title, my point, right?
Yeah.
The publisher is smart, they know.
I'm just seeing if they've actually listed it in this thing.
Oh, yeah.
Another possible title, I don't know. I don't think they have.
Maybe it was that just the edition that came out in tandem with the with the release of the film.
I think it didn't do so well, thankfully.
The film or
no, the book.
The book.
The tie-in. The tie-in.
The tie-in version.
This one always sold better. Yeah.
Oh, that's good to know.
Yeah.
And articles and information about how you're of course having your father and that whole experience. It must have been kind of surreal just having your dad out there meeting. The guy's playing your dad.
De Niro.
Who it was.
Yeah.
And that whole experience. But so I didn't want to spend too much time on that. This was fascinating to me, just sort of kind of getting an idea of where.
Yeah, but I noticed this podcast called Film Wax, right?
It's
Film
very
Wax
true. Isn't
so
it?
I, so
it's
kind I'm of an irony. I was sort of thinking, I was expecting a little film sort of
talk.
So then I diverted it to Blake, before film was even invented, I sort of went back to Blake.
That's fine, though.
Yeah.
Well, I John Lurie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know him, but I know.
Who he is. Yeah. So, well, this was a case where, I approached him through Twitter, because he has a presence on Twitter. Reached out. He doesn't want to talk about. He was open to the idea, and we actually ended up Skyping just to introduce each other, other, and talked for quite a while. But he's got a big person, a complicated personality, mostly in a positive way. But he didn't want to talk about certain people he's worked with in the past, whose name starts with a J, and another who. Tom Waits is another. Yeah. He just didn't want. And so he goes, I don't really want to talk about the films. And I said, well, you don't have to.
Yeah.
And so some time passed. And then one day I saw that he was on a very popular podcast called WTF.
Yeah.
So, and I was just like, oh, wow, okay. And he goes, well, you do a film podcast. I said, well, it's my podcast. I can have on anybody I want, which is getting to the point. I mean, we could have talked about more about that adaptation, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And I'm certainly interested in it, but at the same time, I kind of was just more interested in getting to know, your story a bit.
Yeah, that's I appreciate that. That was not that I would talk about anything. It doesn't matter. But just right now, like this morning, like I said, I was recording this Blake stuff, and so that's sort of what's
that's on your mind the most.
Yeah, that, and then
it's occupying your.
I just found out that my next book of poems just got taken. I found that out this morning. By Grey Wolf. So,
oh, right. And they've done all your past...
They've done the past books of poems, so, yeah.
Yeah.
They do, so they do the poetry, yeah.
They've been in for the big... for the journey here.
Yeah, and they well, and it's never certain.
Right?
This will be the fifth collection, mm-hmm. and it's never certain, you know, like if they didn't like it, they wouldn't take it, I would hope. So, and it took them a while. Like, I was actually a little wondering. Uh-huh. So the new one's called I Will Destroy You. Uh-huh. It's the new book of poems.
And when is that coming out? I mean, when is the
don't know. Usually it's like, you know, what's going to be 2017 soon, probably 2018.
Oh, really?
Oh, it takes at least a year, yeah.
Just from the time of letting you know where the sign-on.
I think if we're lucky, it'll be 2018.
So My Feelings, is that the name of it?
Yeah, My Feelings.
My Feelings, which I think is a great title.
Yeah.
I think you read from that at when I met you a couple weeks ago at the New York Cafe.
No, I think I read from this.
You read from that?
The
Did
new
you
book.
Read? Did you read from
the? Yeah, okay. I read from the new book. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, maybe you're right, actually.
I did, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I didn't, because I'm sort of, just I was in the middle of these poems, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I shifted over to the Blake right after that, so, yeah.
And that's, I'm obviously very excited about it, so hence your, or just inspired.
Well, it's like workshopping them. Like you read them in public just to see how they work, and it's sort of a way to edit them, mm-hmm. too. Yeah,
sure.
The book needs to be edited.
Is reading? I noticed, like at that evening, which was this part of this little
the International Literature Festival. Yeah,
yeah. You first of all, do they count Massachusetts now as an international? I was wondering. First of all, I did wonder why.
Well, technically, I think it's international, isn't it?
Well, you're American is international to all the other countries that were up there.
Yeah,
it's international in the sense of these are just different writers from all different countries, including our own.
Was I the only one that was like sort of from Massachusetts? Like,
or in America.
Nick Laird was from England, and mm-hmm. the other people were maybe even based in America, but they weren't from America.
Oh, yeah, they were?
Maybe they think I'm not from America. I don't know.
I
was happy to be
just
there,
calling something like we have international film festivals. That just means that in addition to domestic films, there is also international titles.
I guess that's what they did.
So that must be what that is about.
But sometimes they're under the false impression that like if they put like, you know, my name or someone else local person's name in, more people will come because they'll know that name.
Right. Well, that makes
which
sense.
Which turns out not to be true at all. But
it was a decent turnout for us. It was a small venue. Let's face it. And I'm always
I was totally happy with it. I was very happy with to be
nice
with
vibe.
Those poets. Yeah, that was
sure.
great. So it was really fascinating.
Yeah,
a great. Festival they do,
but I saw on this, and we can finish here, but I just realized reading and the cadence and the tone is so crucial, and it must take just forever to kind of get that, you know, to develop that. It's almost like singing in the sense of you have to develop a tool.
Yeah, well, and two of these, well, like I said the Blake thing is being done with the idea of performing it with a musician, the whole thing. So a lot of what I'm editing is for that, for what will be, and I'm recording it to see what can actually, you know, what comes out of your mouth and what can fit in your mouth. And with this other one too, I did a lot of these poems with these two musicians, these two great musicians, Simi Stone and Philip Marshall. A lot of these were workshop with them. We performed mm-hmm. them with mm-hmm. with a band, and so that was like a way to have them in the world too. So
yeah,
and they change now. They have this musical element, even if you don't hear it. You know, if I don't perform them with the music, it's still in it. So, yeah.
It has
embodied.
Yeah. Well, I don't know.
Imbued.
That's a good.
Infused.
Impressed. I don't know.
Impressed. Is it palimpsest? Yeah.
Is that what that means? Palimpsest.
Well, palimpsest is like the pressure on a piece of paper that's then erased, and you can sort of see the ghost image of it.
Okay, is that what they do on gravestones too, or is that something different?
That's grave rubbings. Yeah, yeah. Which you can actually see the thing. This is like it's like a white piece of paper, but there's like a like maybe the pressure of the pen on it.
Mm-hmm.
Like if a notepad, I think if you wrote on one page and took it off, then that's
I think that's a palimpsest. I could be. You're gonna get a shitload of bad. You know.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Email about will be this. Listening. Saying, what, that's good.
You know.
I'm glad to know that there. I think a lot of people will be interested in this episode actually, because I think you're a great, great writer and storyteller. And, maybe we'll get a chance one day to do it again. And,
we'll have to come. You'll have to come and hear the Blake performance when I do it here.
That'll
probably be sooner. It'll probably be sooner than the Book of Poems, just because that's, you know, I can control this.
Is that I think the dog's scratching or something.
Unless it's your.
Unless my son is scratching at the door. Oh, that's a good point. I do have that.
Grendel next. Somebody's Grendel up next.
Somebody tails me all the time.
Yeah.
The dog. All right. Well, Nick, thank you so much, really. And
it's
a pleasure to getting to know you.
Yeah.